We wrapped up another big week of coronavirus coverage right here on Connecticut Today, Friday, April 17th. We were joined by an area college professor from the University of New Haven looking at how the tourism and hospitality industries are going to have to recover after COVID-19. Our buddy Tom Dudchick checked in from the online and television versions of the Connecticut Report. He recently spoke to Governor Ned Lamont, House Speaker Joe Arisimowitz, and Danbury Mayor Mark Boughton about the ongoing COVID-19 outbreak. We, of course, carried the governor's daily remarks for you live on the show, and we wrapped it up with a focus on Fairfield County and the General Assembly from Fairfield Republican State Senator Tony Wong. Well, a lot of folks out there are wondering, when can I ever take a vacation again? When will I ever be able to, if I want to, hop on a cruise ship, a big cruise liner, maybe go to a hotel? How long before there's any sort of normalcy to that business, if ever? Joining us right now is Dr. Jan Jones, professor of hospitality and tourism at the Business College at the University of New Haven. Dr. Jones, good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good. I'm broadcasting live and in color from my son's old bedroom, but I'm on the air, and that's all that counts in the Wallingford Bureau. Boy, Dr. Jones, if you are somebody in the cruise industry, the museum industry, the airline industry, the hotel industry, I don't know. What are you thinking right now if somebody is involved in those businesses?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the thinking even changes on a daily basis right now, unfortunately. just trying to stay ahead of the curve in terms of what even to recommend to people is becoming, it seems more challenging by the day, not less challenging, I think. We're just kind of, I think, all in a bit of a state of a shock, and deadlines keep moving out as to what and when we'll be able to travel again.
And
get back to anything normal.
And even if and when that happens, Dr. Jones, you know, that's done generally with disposable income. I mean, that's done with ha-ha money. That's done with money that maybe some people have saved a year or two or three to, you know, have that special vacation or go to Disney World or to, you know, visit the Rockies or take that train trip. So even if the planes and the trains and the cruise ships get a swab down and are clean, that doesn't mean the business is going to come back necessarily right away, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're really hit on quite a few topics there. I mean, the first is discretionary income is what our industry relies on. And there's two major situations going on right now. Some people are actually able to save because they can't do anything. Mm-hmm. But that's the people that are fortunate enough to have jobs right now. Other people are really struggling, and it's going to take them some time to get back on their feet. And yeah, certainly that's a big issue. And I think the other thing you just mentioned is that these industries are going to have to really right now be working on policies and transparency in terms of sanitation and safety. People don't travel if they don't feel safe. And this has hit us in a way, I think, different than some of the things we've seen in the past where it's such a global impact. And it is going to take some time for some of these industries to get back on track. And I think it will be slow in some cases.
Man, if you are involved with the cruise industry per se, I've cruised a couple of times. I've enjoyed it. But, you know, Dr. Jones, mm-hmm. we see all the time when you get and forget the coronavirus, whenever there's the norovirus or Legionnaire's mm-hmm. disease, whenever we see one of these viruses pop up, you know, you can have all the fresh ocean air you want. These ships, these huge mega ships that are the size now of, you know, mega hotels, 4,000 or 5,000 people, these ships are like floating petri dishes when this sort of stuff happens.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, the challenge with cruise ships in particular and a lot of transportation is that the turnover of people is nearly impossible to kind of keep up with. And these are small cities on these cruise lines. I do think that some of the regulations and standards as to what kind of health care is available on board is just simply going to have to change. I think moving forward that these cruise lines are going to have more on board in terms of dealing with stuff like this. But sanitizing for 7,000 people on a cruise ship is not an easy task. And also in terms of food service and how we manage food, things like buffets and stuff like that, we're really going to have to re-examine sort of policies and standards for how that food is going to be delivered.
Dr. Jan Jones is the guest. She's a professor of hospitality and tourism at the University of New Haven. The airline industry, Dr. Jones, really coming under a microscope here. You know, they want cash. They tell the feds, we need cash. The feds are saying, hey, we'll give you some cash, but you've got those nice big airplanes and those terminals that you could put up as collateral for loans. So how about we do a deal here? But I know a lot of the airlines, Dr. Jones, are pushing back on this. They, at least as of last week when I was reading some sites, they're not too hip on taking out loans here, are they?
No, I mean, a lot of these, I mean, and it just depends on the industries, right? Some of them are bigger and more capable of taking some of these problems on, but some of them just really do need help from a business perspective. The travel industry in just overall really does need support. And I feel like sometimes it's the last to get support, since there are sort of life-threatening kinds of organizations that you really need to make sure that have some kind of plan in place for something like this. And but yeah, travel industries right now are gonna they're really struggling, and it is still important to support them because moving forward it is going to be essential to getting our economy kind of back on track as well.
And I don't think the average person, Dr. Jones, stops and thinks of the fact that it's not just, you know, a bunch of rich people on a cruise and people who can stay in a hotel in Las Vegas. These cruise ships have, okay, if there's 7,000 people on a boat, there's also a couple of thousand crew members on there from the engineering and the service staff. And the same thing with hotels. If a hotel stays empty, right, or if any of the Disney properties are closed, people aren't getting their paychecks.
Yeah, and that is something I think a lot of people don't think about. And even a cruise that goes into a port, the people that are associated in any way with those cruise lines are really struggling right now. And countries in particular that really depend on the money coming in, GDP, is so connected to travel in so many countries right now. So, yeah, this unfortunately filters down to almost every single aspect of our industry. It impacts the events, the hotels, the restaurants, small business owners. This is the only time I've ever seen it this bad, and I think everyone would agree that, in some ways, it's regional, and people may just travel domestically for a while and things eventually get back on track, but this is just not the same. It is impacting every aspect of industry.
And it's not just the Las Vegas-type destinations or the Caribbean or the Disney destinations. Every state, including us here in Connecticut, we have our aquariums, our zoos, like the Beardsley Zoo here in Bridgeport, those little craft villages. I mean, even down to that micro level, people will, unfortunately, for the time being, until everything gets better, and it will, they have to stay away from those areas.
Yes. 100% agree with you. And a lot of people don't really think about how much tourism brings into even their own local communities. And that's what's devastating right now, is we can't even rely on domestic travel. We really can't travel right now. We really cannot be in those facilities. And the more we push to get back too soon, the longer this is all going to last. And so, yeah, it is. It's really unfortunate. I think the landscape of who exists after this is going to be very interesting to watch. Some of these really small companies are really going to struggle to be able to reopen.
Hospitality, tourism, vacations, jet travel, train travel on the cruise lines. A lot of folks saying, well, we won't need that for a while. Well, maybe not, but there are people that work in those industries, hundreds of thousands in the U.S. and across the world. What happens to them once we get our head above water in this COVID situation? Dr. Jan Jones, a few more minutes with her. She is a professor of hospitality and tourism at the College of Business at the University of New Haven. Boy, Dr. Jones, Jones, what do you think the industry shifts into or looks like after we're done with this? I know you alluded to right before the break, you said smaller operators. You think the smaller operators get bought out, get gobbled up by some of these companies that made it through this or will make it through this because they have more liquid capital to rely on?
Yeah, I think definitely some of the larger corporations or organizations or companies in general are going to have a little bit more flexibility in what they're going to be able to do or not do. I do think that the very, you know, the small business owners are really going to struggle the most after this. I also think the landscape is going to change a little. I don't think there's going to be just a, okay, everyone can travel tomorrow. There's going to be a slow kind of re-entrance back into the market. And I think you're going to see that's when you're really going to see who's able to survive. And unfortunately, I do think some companies that we've known and had around for a very long time, and this is globally, not just locally, are not going to necessarily be able to reopen. It's hard to kind of, you know, pinpoint exactly what's going to happen because there's just still so many unknowns. But the longer this goes on, the harder it's going to be for some of these companies. And it also depends on the diversity of a company, right? So just as an example for a restaurant, if they have the ability to do very, you know, decent takeout right now, and they're still able to make at least, you know, stay, keep their heads above water, that's good. But there's some companies that just really, they're just not able to make any money right now. And they're just not going to be able to, I think, unless they get some kind of help, they're not going to be able to stay afloat.
You know, if those
I think you're going to see mergers and you're going to see, people taking larger companies probably taking over some of the smaller ones. But
if those Olive Garden, if those Olive Garden breadsticks go away, I have no idea what I'm going to do. I just don't know. I don't know. What's going to be interesting too, Dr. Jones, to see is the refund and business practices of some of these companies. I know there's been controversy where Congress is telling the airlines, no, you should give people back their money for these tickets. And I know some of the airlines are saying, well, here's a 125% voucher. I have a friend of mine who's going through that right now. She's arguing with, I think it's Air Canada. And Air Canada, not to bash them, but she told me the other day, I said, well, you got your money back, right? She goes, no, they're refusing to give me my money back. So I think we may see a little banging of heads on that, you know, refund policies, whether it's planes, trains, or hotel accommodations.
Yeah, I actually think you're going to see a lot of this. And I mean, I've written a couple articles about this now in terms of transparency is just so important right now. And, you know, the information you're putting out there to customers has to be very clear, very concise as to what exactly it is that you're offering or not offering. And I do really sympathize with these companies because at the end of the day, they still have to, you know, make money. And in order to survive, they're going to have to come up. They have to be very. It's not an easy landscape for them to navigate right now. But yeah, I mean, and I feel like the it just changes daily, right? The expectations of what companies should and shouldn't do, and openings, and you know, when is it right to what are the right cutoff dates for people? I've even seen some movement recently of. You know, it used to be like, okay, May, and now we're moving off into July, August, September in some cases. So, and some companies are moving out a year in terms of events and things like that. So I really just think that right now it's super challenging for companies to come up with clear policies, but it's so, so very important. So the customer understands exactly what kind of refund they're going to get.
Absolutely. It's not going to be easy. And a lot of these companies, too, Dr. Jones, a final point here, I think, is that a lot of these companies, most of them, in fact, I don't know if any of them are privately held. I'm sure some of them are. These are companies, these airlines and hospitality companies, they have stockholders. These are not publicly held companies that, you know, okay, we can bite the bullet. It's a family-owned company. We're okay. We're going to hunker down. You know, a lot of these airlines, these hospitality companies, if they don't have their stockholders around to get dividends, they lose a major part of their operating capital.
Yes, Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is, like I said, and that's, this is, I don't envy anyone that's trying to come up with refund policies or policies for customers right now. The sad thing is that the customers aren't canceling trips because they want to cancel trips. No. They're canceling trips because they have to. And so, and same for the businesses, right? So it really is, you really try to have to see both sides of it. I am very sympathetic to any of these organizations trying to come up with these policies right now. And I think it's going to be a moving target. I think we're going to see, you know, it's not going to be that things are set in stone, because it continues to change as to when we're going to be able to get back to any kind of normal travel industry.
Dr. Jan Jones, a professor of hospitality and tourism, College of Business, University of New Haven. Dr. Jones, thanks so much. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Have a great day.
Here's a guy who's working out of Capitol Report World Headquarters, the world terminus of the Capitol Report, ctcapitalreport.com on the internet, and of course, the Capitol Report every Sunday morning, 10 a.m. on News 8. The one and only, you know him, you love him, Tom Dudchick's with us. Tom, how are you?
Paul, nice to hear your voice. I thought you lost my phone number for
Jeez, I'm taking a shot all the time.
Taking a shot off the top, Paul. Come on.
He gives me the forearm shiver right off
there
the top.
From world, yeah, we're socially distancing here. World Caliper headquarters in East Haddam, Connecticut.
Nice.
I do go down to the studio today at 10 o'clock to tape Capitol Report. We had the governor on today,
yeah,
along with Mayor Mark Boughton, socially distanced, and Speaker of the House Joe Arisimowitz. So it was a fun program.
You know, I think overall, for a guy who was never really a political animal and kind of the accidental governor, I think Governor Lamont's done a good job. What do you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, and on the program today, we talked about the recent HarperCollins Syracuse SHU poll that basically echoes those same remarks, that he is getting good marks. And on national polls, when people ask basically overall how their governor is doing, their governors get good marks too. And I think, Paul, I think what makes him a good governor in this situation, I think, was what held him back in being a more aggressive governor in the past, where you had a governor like Malloy, who kind of was a my way or the highway guy, and, you know, twisted arms and said to the legislature, here's what I'm going to do, and if you don't want to do it, then too bad, I'm doing it anyways. Whereas Governor Lamont was always kind of a consensus builder.
Yeah.
He would try to get people to come along and try to get Len Fasano to come along and vote with some of the Democrats and bring proposals. And, you know, as it turns out, that's difficult to do because, you know, the legislature says, okay, we don't need you, we'll do what we want. And he's like, what? No, come on, you know, let's all do this together. And that's really not how politics works. But in a situation like this, where you do need consensus and you do need to build relationships with mayors and hospitals across the state and suppliers, his style does work. So I think that's what you see right now.
And again, Tom, we're not talking about taxes here or tolls or legal weed or gambling. We're talking essentially about saving lives here. And I think everybody has looked each other in the eye and said, okay, now we've got to get serious. Now, Joe Lieberman used to tell me all the time when I would talk to him and he was in office, he said, you know, when we went into the Senate Intelligence Committee or the Homeland Security Committee, you know, everybody's party affiliation got checked at the door because the stuff we talked about in those committees transcended party. I think we're seeing that here, Tom, as well.
Yeah, I think you know, there is still a lot of partisanship, and Paul, I think you're starting to kind of sense a little bit of restlessness now.
Yeah.
And across the country, I think there's this blue state, red state divide on who's going to open their states up and who's getting restless. Even in Connecticut, I noticed yesterday the conservative caucus, about 10 to 12 Republicans sent a letter to the governor saying, you know, you're killing us. You know, you can't, you know, why can't towns that have a few cases or no cases, why can't we open? And the governor said even today on my program that, well, if, for instance, if Wilton only had three cases and everything else is closed down, we let Wilton open, everyone's going to come into Wilton to go drinking, you know, and then bring the coronavirus with him. So I think there's a lot of issues about when we open and how we open, and especially in your neck of the woods, Paul, down there in Fairfield County with Metro North. I mean, how do we...
Oh.
How do we open railroads when it looks like, you look like a state like California, who doesn't have a lot of cases, doesn't have a lot of deaths? In a small state like Connecticut, even proportionally, there are a lot of positive cases. Well, that's because people going up and down the corridor, going into New York, coming back into Connecticut, and bringing stuff with them. So it's going to be a difficult time, Paul.
You also had Mark Boughton on the show, you said, for this Sunday, Tom and Joe Arasimowitz. Mark Boughton was center stage with the governor the other day on one of his daily briefings. Listen, Mark Boughton is a lot of people have often wanted him to be the Republican nominee. It hasn't happened. Danbury's a very well-run city, but he's got a boatload of cases in that city as well.
He does, yes. And we talked about that, a lot of cases and a lot of people that are just not obeying the his calls. And everyone's called to stay apart and stay at home and socially distance. And look, we all understand it's difficult to sit in our houses and with our wives and kids and cooking dinner every single night as opposed to going out. But I mean, this is shown to slow the spread. I just hope that people, as the weather gets nicer, don't have a more inclination to get outside again and start this whole thing up again.
Joe Arasimowitz, we are going to eventually get back to politics, Tom. We're only in April. There is an election coming up in November. There are looming, issues in this state other than what the economy is going to be looking like. If I'm not mistaken, Arasimowitz is done, right? So
yes.
Who do you see as the heir apparent to the speakership? Is it Matt Ritter? Is it somebody else? What do you think of that?
I think Matt Ritter pretty much has it locked up again.
Really?
And then when you look at people like Len Fasano, who's announced his retirement, and these are people who have served with great distinction up there. Whether you like or don't like their politics, they're committed public servants, and this is almost kind of like having going through college for 4 years and not being able to walk across the stage, with cap and gown.
Mm-hmm.
These legislators usually have. I think in the case of John McKinney, I timed it out that they spoke for like 4 hours, and I wouldn't sit through 4 hours of anything. Not to mention listening to people talk about Johnny McKinney, but that's what they do. And so that goes by the wayside. But I think at some point during the summer, Paul, I think they'll have to come back and do some kind of stimulus program,
yeah,
or some kind of a relief program. If dollars come from the federal government for our local municipalities, our tax receipts are down. The sales tax, which is the engine of the state of Connecticut, that's down. We have all these hedge fund people in Fairfield County who provide a lot of revenue around April 15th to the state of Connecticut. Those guys are all down. So, I mean, they, I think fiscally, there's going to be a very, very difficult time. Don Klepper-Smith, who's an economist here in the state of Connecticut, during the last recession, we had 156,000 jobs lost in the state of Connecticut. He says we still haven't recovered from that. He thinks it's going to be worse. So buckle up.
Who is the heir apparent to Len Fasano in the Senate?
That's a good question, and I don't have an answer for it. I think people are still going to fight that out. I don't think there's any one clear person that comes to mind that you'd say that's him or her.
Are the Republicans in danger because of the Trump factor, Tom Dudchick, of getting hammered and losing even more seats come this November?
I don't know. I give up trying to handicap the president and his effect on elections. I'm sure you have too. You would think based on the midterm elections that you would certainly see a continued trend towards more blue seats in Connecticut. But you never know, Paul. It's a crazy, crazy time we live in right now. I mean, will this dampen turnout? Who's going to get out the vote? Will people be afraid to vote? We don't even know if there's going to be elections it's all going to be mail-in ballots. I mean, we just don't know.
He, of course, has been posting the Connecticut Capitol Report, ctcapitalreport.com, on the Internet for years. The gold standard around the country, and, of course, the television show, The Capitol Report, every Sunday morning, 10 a.m. on News 8. If you sleep in late, make that the first thing you watch when you get out of bed.
Start to set the coffee pot and channel 8.
That's right. A little coffee cake, little Lindemann's cake there, a little coffee, and Tom Dudchick and the Capital Report gang.
And Paul, I think because there are coronavirus rules, I think it's Bloody Marys and mimosas.
Right, Tom. We'll be watching Sunday. Thanks,
Thank
Tom.
Thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it, Bubba. How about that? Bloody Marys, mimosas, and Tom Dudchick Sunday mornings at 10 on News 8. Great show. Great cast of characters he has there.
Hospitalizations, new hospitalizations, that's a net increase of 20. That's a low number. That's good news. Shows again that maybe, just maybe, our social distancing is working, lowering the infection rate, lowering the hospitalization rate. But stop the good news right there. It's a milestone, tragic day. We have over 1,000 of our citizens, members of the Connecticut family, who have now passed away. That's 1,036. Take a moment to just say a prayer for their families. I just want to make a reminder. We spent yesterday talking about reopen Connecticut and what we're going to do to get this state going again in a safe way. We're focusing on that every day, and we'll report back to you on a weekly basis exactly what that strategy is. But I wanted to show you this chart. I was struck by it. I saw this somewhere. You can see measured by weeks and measured by deaths per 1,000 what different impacts are. You can see car crashes at the bottom of that chart, sort of fascinating. You always hear about the number of car crashes. And by the way, car crashes aren't contagious. You see some of the other flus we've heard about, the Asian flu, the 2018 flu, see how they're reflected. And then you see how unique COVID-19 is in terms of its infection rate. And this measures death per millions. In 5 short weeks, it's surpassed cancer and heart disease. So while we celebrate fewer hospitalizations and the fact that we maybe have a chance to slowly get back on normal, don't take your eye off the ball and what a risk this is. And I'll say is just one other thing. I was sort of interested in the numbers I saw today, because we know that it's in the more urban and congested areas that the virus has struck hardest. It started with New York City, and now Bridgeport and Hartford. But it's worth remembering it's growing fastest in our rural states. It's growing fastest in Oklahoma, Nebraska, South Dakota. South Dakota is up over 200% in the last week alone. And those are states that never put in place stay-at-home orders. So again, I just want to remind you the importance of what you're doing and the sacrifices you're making in terms of social distancing. The next chart is one you've seen before. Again, you can see Fairfield and New Haven and Hartford. Again, it's not going up geometrically, maybe flattening out a little bit in those places. Numbers we're watching to give us hope. And the next chart sort of gives you a different way of thinking about the day-to-day change in hospital admissions now. I think of admissions as the best leading indicator, because the net number reflects discharges as well. And if you look at that, you see it goes up and down. There's no reason for a lot of false confidence. But you can say going back from April 1 to April 15, the average day-to-day change in admissions went from about 120 on that particular day down to about 60 on average now, the 3-day moving average. So there is good news there that's worth reflecting on. I just want to say, well, I just might as well make a mention of this as well. We are ramping up the testing. We're doing the testing on a more broad-based basis. So the CVS test, you know, we reached out to the CEO, Larry Merlo of CVS, what was it, 10 days ago, Paul? 10 days ago. And 10 days later, this site is up. It's a drive-through test. You go online, cvs.org. You put in your symptoms. You'll get a ticket that says your symptoms reflect the fact that you ought to have some sort of a test. Open 7 days a week, 700 tests per day, free to everyone. CVS.com, I see. So that This shows you that we're ramping it up, making it available to more people faster. And by the way, our first responders get the first 100 tests every day. First responders, 4 tested positive today. I want to just say one thing about the stress we're feeling as we go into the second month of this pandemic. Obviously, it's just a fear of the disease itself. You can see by those numbers, those COVID numbers. If you're a senior, who's isolated, can't have meals with anybody, it's a sense of isolation as well as just the fear of what the virus could be. And just know that we are getting through this, and the number of people who survive are overwhelming if you don't go to the hospital, and still strong if you have to go to the hospital. But boy, if you're over the age of 65 or so, the best thing to do is stay socially isolated so you don't get. Also, food insecurity. Our 211 United Way calls just reflect the anxiety people have about something as basic as food. I was struck reading the Danbury Times today, and they talked about all the folks driving in to the food bank to get their food, and then at a certain point they stopped delivering the food any longer, and the sense of fear that that represented. I want you to know a couple things. One, our food supply in this state, in this country, and our food banks is strong. Maybe we're not getting quite as much voluntarily donated anymore, given the nature of restaurants and the such, but people are still providing the resources we need to buy it. Obviously, the Dalios gave $1 million a couple of weeks ago. 4CT.org, our amazing philanthropic effort, they donated $1 million just yesterday, and you're going to see a drive-through food share at Rentschler Field on a Monday from 8:30 to 1 o'clock, Monday during the day. There's food for you there. There's food for you at the grocery stores. I was struck by just the small acts of kindness. You know, the Travelers, which is the insurance, which is virtually closed down thanks to telecommuting. And that meant the cafeteria workers there thought they were about to be laid off. And instead, Travelers said, no, we're going to hire you and pay you your salary and benefits, and we're going to use this cafeteria to feed others. And they've been distributing hundreds of meals every day to hands in Hartford, Meals on Wheels, other ways that people are showing small acts of kindness that hopefully give you a sense of hope. Look, volunteercct.org, volunteercct.org. You know, we've had hundreds of volunteers come forward there. You know, hundreds have gone to the food banks and food share, helping out with the distribution of food, making sure that somebody who's got to stay at home, quarantined, still can get a meal delivered, and that's what we're doing. United Way just made an agreement with Grubhub, again, for the delivery of food. You know, we got to stay serious in terms of maintaining our discipline for at least another month, and these are amazing groups that are helping to deal with that, deal with food insecurity, and hopefully reduce the stress you may be feeling. There's obviously the financial distress and a little anxiety for the small business. I know that the Paycheck Protection, they've run out of funds, or they've delivered resources right now. I think something like $4 billion went to the state of Connecticut, so we're making a difference there. Thousands of folks did get their loans, and that will be topped up again in the very near future. But what I really wanted to do was ask two people who are really on the front lines of just the personal sense of distress and anguish that we hear every day. We hear it on our 211 calls. Our teachers hear it as they do telelearning, and they're on the phone with students, but they're also finding a lot of students, if they're absent, we're calling in, finding them, the telecounseling necessary to keep those young people energized, not to mention their parents. And these two people I'd love to have talk just for a few minutes. First is Miriam Delphin Rittman. She is in charge of mental health and addiction here for the state of Connecticut, on the front lines, doing everything she can to provide support for families. And after that, we're going to ask Vanessa Durantes, our amazing leader of the Department of Children and Families. Just tell us a little bit about what they're hearing, the anguish of some of the families that they're reaching out with, and how we're trying to respond. We can do the PSA, or Miriam, what do you propose?
Yes, thank you, Governor.
Hey, Miriam.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having me on. Yes, you know, you mentioned I heard it from our partners and serve about just the stress of this. For many people.
Hey, Max, is there there's an echo there, isn't there?
We have an echo?
It's not coming through clear.
Okay. Yes. So, I mean, what we're hearing is for many people, the social isolation is challenging. That for them, being disconnected from folks can sometimes bring up feelings of anxiety or stress. And for some people, can help them to or contribute to their reliving past traumas and past anxieties. I'm also hearing from some of our community providers that there may be some individuals that are turning to alcohol as a strategy for coping. And so that is something is emerging as a challenge area. We're also hearing that people are reporting trouble sleeping in some instances or overeating as a function of being home and being disconnected from people. We're hearing also that there's a lot of worry about just, you know, one's own health, you know, whether the virus is going to impact people individually or whether it's going to impact family members that they love or some of their friends. And so just a lot of anxiety and worry about sort of what, you know, what this means for people, what it means for their communities, what it means for family members. And so one of the things we've been working on at DEMIS is putting together a DEMIS COVID-19 webpage. It's a one-stop shop for a range of resources to help people with healthy coping skills. There are links to different websites about coping and about strategies for managing stress. There are also a number of resources connected to supports that are available within the area. So for example, there are telephone support lines for young adults. So a support line that's for young adults and run by young adults. And it provides support for people to be able to connect and just share some of their feelings and share what their experience. There are also support lines for family members and people in recovery as well. And all of that is listed on the webpage. We also have links to organizations that are providing online virtual groups. And we know that's important because people are talking about feeling isolated and feeling disconnected from folks. So being able to participate in an online group to be able to share one's feelings is something that's valuable. NAMI Connecticut is offering some of those, as well as Advocacy Unlimited, another group that that we fund. There are also support groups that are being offered by CCAR. So that's the Connecticut Community for Addiction Recovery. These are online support groups that are done virtually by people in recovery for people in recovery. And so those are also available. You know, there are other supports that are available as well that are listed on the webpage. You know, we know that people are still struggling with opioids. So we have a number of resources associated with how people can get connected to medication-assisted treatment or how a person can reach out and receive an assessment about where they are in terms of their substance use and potentially be linked with detox if necessary. And we will still come out and give people a ride to detox if necessary. So if somebody calls our access line, and again, they can get connected to the access line either through 211 or access phone number itself, which is 1-800-563-4086. And again, that's a line where a person can receive an online assessment and then essentially be connected with an appropriate level of services. So again, a number of resources around here. I encourage feeling alone or if they're feeling stressed out, because, you know, certainly what we're going through right now is unprecedented. We have never experienced anything like this as a state or as a country. So the uncertainty associated with it, what many of our providers are telling us, or what I've heard directly, is that people are feeling the stress, and it's beginning to expand. So I encourage folks, if you're struggling, reach out, get support. It's important that we socially isolate, but if you're feeling stressed, it's important not to carry that stress or not to feel it alone, because know that there are others that are there that can be a support and that you can connect with. Again, so the DMIS COVID-19 webpage, you can access it at just Googling DMIS COVID-19. And again, there are a range of different services and supports that are available. I heard about one recently that's available, and it's online yoga. So you can participate in a virtual yoga class. And that sounds pretty exciting. I'm actually going to try that one myself because I did yoga once, and it is quite a workout. So I'm looking forward to trying that one. But again, you can participate in virtual yoga classes, virtual meditation classes, discussion groups. And so these are certainly just opportunities to connect while we're in this sort of phase of staying home to be able to stay safe. So those are just some of the resources we have available. I do want to give a quick shout out to the DMIS employees. I have a number of employees that are working in our inpatient units and across the state, and they are true healthcare heroes. I appreciate their work, and I just want to thank them while I'm here and while I have the floor. So thank you to all the DMIS employees that are out there working with the people we serve with such dedication and commitment and compassion. So I'll stop there. I'm happy to answer any questions when we get to that point. But again, I encourage people to check out the DMIS COVID-19 webpage, and there are a range of services and supports that are available for you if you need those. So thank you.
Thank you, Miriam. Vanessa, are you there?
Please unmute.
You have to unmute, I think.
That's been the story of my life, working through this virtual world. So hello, Governor, how are you? You know, all families need help at times, and this is a particularly difficult time for us all. As Commissioner Delvin Rittman talked about, reaching out for help at this time is also a sign of strength. And we at DCF are pleased to work with our partners at United Way 211 and many local private providers in collaboration for what we're calling When It Builds Up, Talk It Out. And so, you know, we know at DCF that families are the single greatest strength of support for their children, and communities are the greatest source of strength for our families. And we believe in community. And so with that, we've tapped our community private providers to help us during this crisis, and it's been immediately embraced. So when we begin to think about using our providers, we think about how we can connect with very talented and dedicated resources who support families and support treatment of families and their children. So the department already contracts with many of these providers, and we invite any parent or caregiver to talk it out. What you're going to hear in a few minutes is an opportunity for us to be able to use trained professionals when families need support, understanding, or a referral to specialized services such as clinical treatment, domestic violence counseling, or just help with food, housing, financial assistance, and the connections that many of us need during this crisis. Reaching out for support is healthy, it's normal, and it can make you an even better and stronger parent. So we're launching a public service campaign using donated advertising time from Connecticut's TV and radio stations to help us get the word out. We're soliciting parents and caregivers who could benefit from just talking to a professional who can understand and invited to call. We'll show the PSA in a minute, but the call line is 833-258-5011 or simply talkitoutct.com.
Right now, it can feel impossible to be a parent or caregiver. With everything going on, the pressure just builds up, and it can be so hard to keep it in. But if it ever gets to be too much to take a step back and take out your phone. Call the Talk It Out line. We're here to listen, to understand, and to talk your feelings out. When it builds up, talk it out.
Oh, that's marvelous, Vanessa. Thank you for that.
It's an opportunity for us to recognize the humanity of us all.
Hi.
You know, this crisis has brought about stressors, but we know that Connecticut is strong. We know that families are strong, and we know that we'll be resilient on the other side. But during this crisis, sometimes you just need to talk it out.
Talk it out. Thank you.
Our buddy, Republican State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield. Tony, I just saw this picture you sent me. You are wearing your mask, which is good. And you seem to be helping out at some sort of operation. What is going on there, Tony?
Well, it really was an incredible outpouring of people stepping up and making significant contributions. This is the Chinese, Connecticut Chinese American community in a coordinated effort to try to procure hard-to-get PPE supplies and gowns, and really try to make sure that we are protecting our frontline healthcare workers. And we did it today at two different locations, Paul. We did it at the Yale Medical School, as well as at the state capitol, in delivering goods to Hartford Healthcare System, which tragically had their first casualty of a medical frontline worker to the COVID crisis. And it really reinforced again the real need to get protective measures to protect the people that are saving lives, but they're at the front line of dealing with this. And really, Paul, I got to tell you, I was really struck by the raw emotions that I felt. You know, we hear so much and watch so much about the news and how it's affecting and the numbers, but for me, it just hit me. I felt the emotion, first with the gratitude and the outpouring of the generosity and efforts of a fellow Connecticut Chinese Americans donating nearly 20,000 valuable KN9 masks for healthcare providers in protective gowns. It was an amazing display of community outpouring, a real commitment to being helpers. But I almost cried when I saw the gratitude of the medical physicians that were receiving these products. Dr. Desar at Yale, the chief of internal medicine, the vice president of medical affairs, Dr. Steinberg, when they saw these PPE donations, I could tell you they nearly came to tears of gratitude. And that's when it really hit me, Paul, that when we're talking about all the things that are impacting people's lives, all the inconveniences, these are moments when we have to remind ourselves that there's tremendous people out there, from our medical providers that are at the front line risking their lives to save lives, to people that are making differences and sacrifices to be able to contribute and help protect those people that are on the front lines.
And you know, Tony, whenever we get through this thing, and we will, because as Americans we always do, one thing I want to see, and I'm sure it's going to be talked about by you folks, you guys and gals of both parties in the General Assembly. Look, we have reserves in this country for a lot of things. In fact, the world has a seed reserve in case there's ever an all-out nuclear war. A part of the National Petroleum Reserve is apparently housed in those big oil tanks at the intersection of 91 and 95 in New Haven. Tony, I think that knowing this has happened and it could happen again, scientists are saying we're not out of the woods on this yet, and there may be others down the road. We need a collaborative effort by the federal government and the state government to, much as we have petroleum stored in tanks, we need to develop, if it means, Tony, building up warehouses either below ground or above ground, and even if it means we stock these warehouses with gowns and gloves and masks and do it in a way that environmentally protects them and there's no dry rot, we have to get this done, because the next time this happens, and it will happen, we can't go scrounging around for this stuff, Tony, in the richest, most powerful country in the world.
These are lessons that I've heard, and Paul, I think it was maybe in one of your programs where we heard some of the renowned experts come out and say, look, these were pandemic scenarios that were practiced and rehearsed, and prioritization and being able to stockpile and prepare for pandemics maybe as long as 5 years ago. But it got stuck in budgeting and prioritization in regards to allocation. Well, I think we have learned powerful lessons and in that moving forward, the new normal, and I hope we get to it soon for the sake of our quality of life as well as our health and safety, but also for our economy and businesses. And when we get to the new normal, we then need to recognize that these type of preparations, these type of precautions need to be put into place. And I hope we get there sooner versus later. But you're absolutely right, Paul. I hope this is a valuable lesson that we take every precaution so that we don't get to the pandemic stages that we have, because we have now learned the lesson. You know, the last major pandemic that hit this country was literally 100 years ago, the 1918 Spanish flu. And you know what? Maybe we learn our lesson so that we don't repeat, you know? It's learning from our history, so don't have to repeat it.
Yeah, and you know, Tony, I would even go, and I know this is crazy, but I ask people, well, what other solution would you have? They say, well, there's no bed space, there's no hospital space, we're crunched. You know, Tony, I would even go, and I've even heard this floater from other people, you designate a facility in the state, maybe one or two, as standby hospitals. Now, I know FEMA's already doing that, but, you know, Tony, you have so many of these buildings that are unoccupied or go unoccupied for years, or they're used as storehouses or warehouses. So I'm just saying, I think in the future we need to designate a couple of buildings that, yeah, you can still use for a primary use, but maybe within, you know, a week or so, you can just go in there, flip the lights on, bring some crews in there, and you would have a ready-made hospital. Just a wacky idea, but again, I hope that we continue to kind of think outside the box on this stuff.
Well, we have to think outside of the box, Paul, and we have to do it in a dynamic of public-private partnerships to make sure this is sustainable into the future. I think one of the biggest challenges we're seeing in regards to the federal stimulus program and the challenges that we have with the PPP running out, and even in the state program, that government cannot be the solution. It has to be part of the problem. But at the same time, we have to empower and encourage innovation, fast-paced successes that really meets the need that we have. And we can only do it with entrepreneurialism, with the private sector being bought into this partnership. You know, when you think about the Abbott's rapid testing and the various ways that we have to get to solutions, these are industries, private companies that are making these initiatives, and we're adopting it in government and the fast approval process. This is what we have to do as a new dynamic is government, for those people that think it's the ultimate solution, it isn't. We have to do a public-private dynamic and foster this kind of sustainability and viability into the future. But to rest all of our eggs into the government basket, I would throw caution to that, because it's not demonstrated to be efficient nor successful. And we need to move forward in a public-private dynamic and really empower people. People are going to get us out of this mess, and the people are going to lead us out of this mess.
And our good buddy at the radio station here, Republican State Senator Tony Wong of Fairfield. Tony, as we continue to get a handle on this medically, and we will, and apparently, and eventually, whether it takes 6 months, 8 months, a year, this will go away, or we'll get a handle on it. We have to look at the trail of destruction and mayhem that this thing has left. And I'm sure you people in the General Assembly are already seeing projections about state finances. You know, through no fault other than a disease, the state, Tony, I guess, until the sales tax revenues rev up again, we're looking at the possibility of significant red ink, correct?
Well, absolutely. Sales tax has always been the baseline of our revenue dependency. Even in the most challenging of economic times, our sales tax has always been a good base. But unfortunately, you have nothing going on due to this pandemic. You have no transactions. You have a dramatic decline in sales tax that we haven't even calculated, Paul. this is really unprecedented from a economic analysis. I think the Office of Fiscal Analysis is really bracing for itself for what may come to be. And look, we anticipated bad unemployment numbers. What real numbers came out are staggering beyond belief. My biggest concern is we truly, in the budgeting process, have as legislative body and the governor's office, have to prepare for the worst and pray for the best. But nonetheless, these are devastating times, because when you look at past economic challenges, it may be certain regions, it may be certain sectors. This is a worldwide pandemic, and the devastation of the immediate shutoff is something that we can't really fully comprehend unless you're talking up and down Main Street, as I have, Paul, in talking about the emotions of people who have seen fear, frustration, and the possibility of their savings and their dreams of building a viable ownership in a small business literally evaporate overnight. And the other part is for these good business owners that bought insurance policies against everything that may happen, well, insurance doesn't cover a viral pandemic.
It's an act of God considered, right?
It's an act of God, but from what I've been hearing, they're not covered.
Yeah.
So you buy all this insurance for the what if, and guess what? It's not there when you need it.
And I had a listener, Tony, call me the other day because I was kind of floating this out, saying, well, would the banks pull a timeout on this? And this listener told me, and again, I was taking him at his word, he said many mortgages and business loans are written in the fact that you do not get a break if, in fact, a pandemic. He said he has seen actual loans and mortgages with the word pandemic in it, saying that you will have no relief from this. So that's scary, too.
Well, I have said this. I thought the governor overreached when he extended the 60-day grace period. I understood the rationale for it. But it's a delicate balance that he has to maneuver when he's talking about economic solutions. He can't be, as I said earlier in your show, government cannot be the end-all solution. So you got to partner with our business enterprises, entrepreneurs, and people that are taking the risk and owning businesses to see how we can get to it. But the reality is the federal government stimulus program, the PPP program, is oversubscribed and have run out of money. And what I'm hearing horror stories up and down Main Street with small businesses, we're talking about 2 to 5 to 10 employees. Unfortunately, the federal legislation said if you're under 400, 500 people, you're considered a small business. Well, in the state of Connecticut, that's a big business. But the problem at hand is this. I am hearing stories that banks, instead of acting like George Bailey in A Wonderful Life of savings and loans and helping extend credit and supporting their neighbors and businesses in their struggle, unfortunately, I'm hearing way too many stories of banks becoming Mr. Potter, tightening up credit and just really bunkering down. That, to me, is unacceptable, because businesses need them more than ever, and they need to be a partner in helping them survive.
Yeah,
not
a lot
just
of people
grow, but survive.
Yeah, a lot of people, Tony, don't understand that it's the banks that have to administer this program. Tony, thank you. We appreciate it, and we'll check back with you down the road. Stay safe and be good.
Thank you very much. Always a pleasure.